Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network listeners. I am Jeff Hawkins, co-host of Shake Them Ropes, with a very special announcement. If it's been a while or you've never listened to us before, the original gang is back. Myself and Rob McCarron, back talking wrestling. We have no idea where this show's going to go, where we're going to keep any of the old bits or any of the old things in there. It's going to be a process. It's going to be a journey, and we'd like for you to come along with us only on Shake Them Ropes on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to another episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. My name is Tyler Fornes, and with me as always is my co-host, Fred Moreland. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I've got a cat laying on me that does not want to be moved, so it's going to be a very interesting balancing act as my cell phone immediately vibrates. I am a professional. We've been doing this for, 2 years? I'm good at this. I'm about as good at this as I am as I'm about as good at this as Alabama is at running the football in the SEC championship game.
Fred, did you know that you had more rushing yards in the SEC championship game than Alabama did?
We all did. But hey, whenever you get the opportunity to put a team into the college football playoff that gets -3 rushing yards in a big game against a fellow playoff competitor, you just got to do it.
Oh, yeah. See, I'm so tired of hearing about Alabama that I just decided to yawn mid-show. We're incredible professionals here. No, Alabama obviously made the college football playoff, and they shouldn't have.
Probably not. I mean, really, when you get down to it, we're talking about the 10th best team in the country, and like, I kind of don't give a shit. Mm-hmm. At that point, like, to a certain extent, like, you know, if you're gonna maybe not get that spot, if you're gonna get the 11th spot and then be really angry about it and maybe rage quit your bowl game and then yell at the ACC about, you know, how they mistreated you because their network no one watches replayed the game that Miami beat you in, I don't know, maybe I think that I wouldn't crash out over that and instead would maybe, I don't know, lose twice. I would instead maybe just lose once. I guess I'm built different.
The Notre Dame thing is so funny. It's so petty. It's so stupid. So the New Year's Six games are kind of obsolete at this point. But
they're still fun. I mean, it's Notre Dame, Texas, man.
No, they're obsolete because they're a part of the college football playoff.
Yeah.
But they kind of fight in the Pop-Tarts Bowl, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm sorry. I'm
the Pop-Tarts Bowl.
Yeah. You turn America against you by crapping on the one bowl game left that everyone loves and cares about. Also, like, the ACC has never done, you know, conspiratorial stuff against, like, maybe the top teams in the conference.
Yeah.
Like conspiratorial stuff. But
one of my favorite tidbits about this college football playoff field is Miami made the college football playoff before they won the ACC.
Yep.
And if they win the national championship, it will be very funny.
Mm-hmm.
They won't win the national championship, but if they do, it'll be very funny. But they also are the first conference to ever have a participant make it and the conference champion didn't.
Yeah.
Which is also very funny.
Oh, Duke did the funniest thing they possibly could, which thank you for your service. Now, it was very funny to watch them immediately after the game be like, we should be in the playoff. And it's like, nah, nah, you shouldn't. Yeah, I mean, also, I think what's really ridiculous was the ESPN talking heads yelling about how the real problem caused here is by the group of five teams. Like, I don't know, man, maybe shut up. That's a really crappy argument. And, being mad that James Madison is in there when they went 12-1, like, I don't know, they took care of business on the field. What more, you know, it's more than I could say about Alabama or Notre Dame or Miami.
They didn't beat a single team ranked in the top 50, which necessarily their fault.
It's not really, no. It's, you play who's in front of you. There's no central agency controlling scheduling.
And here's the thing. It's not like you can make the argument that, hey, these college football playoff games are always good. Mm-hmm. SMU went 11-2, and they lost on a last-second field goal in the ACC title game last year. And they got whipped by, 26 by Penn State?
Oh, yeah. And let's be clear, they're going to be James Madison will probably be put in the figure four leg lock by Oregon. You know, that doesn't change that. Oregon is probably one win away from being talked in the same tier as Indiana and Ohio State and, you know, those teams. Yeah. Georgia.
Don't forget, Indiana beat them in Eugene by 10.
They did, yeah, because Indiana is really damn good. But I mean, Oregon's really damn good too. Like, you know, let's be clear there. That's all I'm saying. But you know, it's this whole silly they wouldn't have done as well as Notre Dame. I don't care, man. Again, if you can't clearly earn your way into the top 10 or 11 teams or you know, whatever, sounds like a personal problem. Don't come whining to me about it. Just absolutely no sympathy about it. And yes, you and probably the listeners know I'm a big shutdown Fullcast fan, and Ryan Nanny went on a rant on this week's show about how he doesn't think 3U lost teams should ever be in the playoff, and as a at large at least. But I think it'd be really hard to make it as a conference champion in most circumstances. But I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I do think that if a team were to lose to Indiana and Ohio State and Georgia this year, and then you know, in nice tight games and dominate the rest of the teams, I'd have no problem with them getting in, but that's definitely not what happened with Alabama. So
I don't think you should put in there that a 3-loss at large team can't make the college football playoff, because
there's always going to be circumstances. You know,
We had a bunch of 2-loss teams this year. Mm-hmm. All it would have taken is Notre Dame to lose to USC, Miami to lose to one other team, Vanderbilt lose to Tennessee, and then all of a sudden, all of your two-loss teams now have 3. So yeah. I think that idea is pure. The intent behind it, I completely understand. My big thing is you need to get rid of all these fucking bozos on the college football playoff committee and hire junkies, college football junkies, to run it. Because you know what? They will actually do a good job, because there's zero reason why you had Notre Dame over Miami all that time. And then last week, we're going to flip it because of head-to-head. No, it should have just been that way the entire time. You absolute idiots. And they gave Alabama credit twice for that Georgia win. And they didn't give them any discredit for losing by 3 touchdowns on a neutral site. Or guess what? BYU lost by 3 touchdowns. Neutral site. They got penalized for it. Ohio State lost by a field goal. They got penalized for it. I'm sorry. It's okay to use different criteria for different teams in different situations, because the way the criteria is laid out is very vague. These are the things that matter. But in each individual case, if you're arguing for two teams, I may talk about strength of schedule in one argument, and I may talk about common opponents in another, and why both of those make sense as far as who's above the other. That's okay. You're using the criteria properly, but each individual case is different. You can't just give every benefit of the doubt to Alabama and none of it to BYU, none of it to Notre Dame. it does not work that way. I still think Vanderbilt should have made the tournament. They should have been in the football playoff.
They or BYU or Utah, I think, all had reasonable claims to that 10 spot.
If Vanderbilt was Alabama, if Alabama had that resume, they would have been in no matter what. It's because it was Vanderbilt.
I personally would like to see the team selection be done by computer at this point, because I think we have proof.
So funny, because we raged about the BCS.
Yeah, but they're kind of crappy computers. They weren't as good. Like Bill Connolly's SP Plus is about as good as it's going to get. And I think that, his 10 picks would have been Ohio State, Indiana, Texas Tech, Oregon, Georgia, Notre Dame, Ole Miss, Texas A&M, Miami, and Utah. I mean, people would have complained about that, but the thing is, they're going to complain about that, the last picks anyway. That's just how this works. Pretending that it's going to change no matter what the metric is fantasy. And I don't know. I mean, like, I seriously think, yeah, sure, why not Utah? Why not? I have no problem with Notre Dame being in. But at some point, if you have two or three losses, yeah, it's kind of on you.
Okay. So you can still calculate the BCS. Here would have been the teams in for the BCS.
Let's do this. Okay? On our AEW podcast.
So, James Madison would have got the 12. Tulane would have got the 11 seed. All right. So those are, they were 18 and 19 on the BCS standings. Okay. Yeah. That's fair. Indiana is one. At 0.9998. Ohio State 2, Georgia 3, Texas Tech 4. So we're back 1,000 so far.
Yeah.
Oregon 5.
And probably the acclaimed top non-conference champion team. Yeah, no problem there.
Oregon 5, Ole Miss 6, Texas A&M 7, Oklahoma 8. We're batting 1,000.
Yeah.
This is exactly what the committee did of those first 10 teams that I mentioned. This is where things get difficult. Notre Dame at 9.
Sure.
Alabama at 10.
Okay.
So Miami would have been the team left out. Yeah. And I've been saying it in all my group chats and anywhere I can say it. I think week 0, every team should be mandated to, every Power 4 team should host an FCS team. And I think they should use it as their preseason game. And then week 1 games will matter a little more, because those week 1 games are such a shit show.
Yeah. Alabama and Florida State, kind of case in point.
Yep. I think they should have been penalized for it, but not nearly as much as they should have been. They weren't penalized for it at all, which is horseshit.
No, not really. And, I can see the argument that, it's week 1 and in the NIL era, like, maybe you give a little grace with that. Still, I think, the worst loss of any reasonable playoff contender, unless I'm forgetting something.
No, the worst loss of any playoff contender is Texas losing to Florida. I don't think it's close.
Really? You think Florida is worse than Florida State?
Florida went 4-8.
Also, I don't really think Texas ended up being like a top tier serious playoff contender. No. Like, they're in that like next 10 batch, but like, I don't
they think were 14th in the final BCS standings.
That seems so a little too many, but
they were the fourth team out per the BCS.
Yeah.
Vanderbilt was 13, BYU 12, Miami 11. For context, Miami is more than 0.1 points behind in the BCS. And if you know the BCS, that is a lot. Like Indiana's over Ohio State by 0.06, which is still a lot, but it's also 1-2, and that's really not that huge of a gap from 1-2, because 1 is usually high powered and they're almost perfect. But everybody's like, we're not going to schedule power conference opponents. I'm like, Texas didn't get in because they lost to Ohio State. They didn't get in because they lost to Florida.
Yeah.
Beat the teams you're supposed to. And you know what? If they're 10-2, they get in because they'll be given credit for trying to play Ohio State, and they would have one conference loss to Georgia.
Yeah. Texas they would have been in for that, but Texas really wasn't a top 10 team this year. No. I mean, if you look at, they crapped the bed pretty good. And Arch, the slipper fell off of Arch Manning's foot, so on and so forth. So, yeah. Who do you have? Who's your pick to win the playoff?
Indiana. I'm going okay. Indiana. I really just, this Indiana team is good.
They are.
And they're not good in a sense of, oh, this is like 2007 Boise State. This team is just good.
Yeah.
I don't care if they don't have the high-powered talent, like the five stars and shit. This is a good football team that's incredibly well-coached and put themselves into positions to succeed. They're tough in the trenches. They have explosive weapons on the outside. They have the presumptive Heisman winner, a quarterback. I'm sorry. Indiana beat Ohio State on a neutral field. And they beat Oregon on the road by 10. This is a damn good football team. And I'm riding Indiana. I want to see Indiana versus Georgia in the national championship game. I think Indiana versus Texas Tech could be one of the better games.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to see that. Yeah.
Indiana, Oklahoma is to me
that's
the likely matchup.
That's some sicko stuff.
It's going to be so good to watch Brent Venables try to stop Fernando Mendoza. I can't wait. And
Oklahoma is a real pervert team this year.
They really are because John Mateer sucks.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he's good in a very specific, very vibes-based way, you know.
John Mateer is I'm trying to think of the wrestler comp for John Mateer. John Mateer is Ruby Soho.
Okay.
When Ruby Soho is in with a good opponent, she's very good. But when she's in with a bad opponent, she kind of stinks. And we talked about that. She wrestles to the level of her competition. John Mateer is just a fucking bozo. And he plays bozo ball. And it's all over the place. And because it's all over the place, I think there's a better comp than Ruby Soho. But that's what I got. So. It's crazy. Because he's got talent to be an NFL quarterback. He's just an idiot.
My heart is with Indiana. I think there's three teams that are logistically the top contenders, which is Indiana, Ohio State, and Texas Tech. I'm guessing that Ohio State wins because, you know, they just take care of business, really. But, you know, I think at E3, those three are very close together. And, of course, with college football, weird things happen. So, you know, any other team like Oregon or Georgia winning would not be a complete shock to me. I think it's very interesting that both Indiana and Texas Tech have top five offenses and defenses by SP+. I think they're the only two teams to do so.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, so, Texas Tech is just a good football team.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Fred.
No one's respecting them enough because, I mean, they played a soft schedule-ish, and, you know, they're in the Big 12, which no one really acknowledges, but they... Yeah.
But
they,
here's the thing about that soft schedule. They mm-hmm. played a top 12 team in BYU, and they smoked them twice.
Yep.
And their only loss was to an up-and-down Arizona State team who went on, was good, and... They did not have Baron Morton, their quarterback. He was out. But their 12 wins all were by 20 or more points. Mm-hmm. They didn't just win.
They killed everyone.
They did. They killed Utah on the road when Utah was undefeated. They just beat the piss out of everybody. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, it's like, okay, if you're in the Big 12 and you're playing a Big 12 schedule, okay, yeah, maybe we can downgrade you a little bit. But they were just destroying everybody. And that to me is a separator. Well, if you're destroying anybody, you go to the SEC. That team probably goes 6-2 in conference.
Yeah, like, if not better, if not 7-1, you know, I think they still would have made the playoff for sure in the SEC or even the Big Ten. I mean, I honestly don't know that outside like the top two or three teams that there was that the rest of those two conferences were that disparate. You know. We'll cut the college football talk short here, but I will say that the Arizona State coach, Kenny Dillingham, if I were Michigan, given everything that happened this week, and it's not really funny what happened this week, it's more and more details came out and it was more and more worse. I'd be looking at Kenny Dillingham from Arizona State. I think that would be a good candidate. Anyways, let's talk about pro wrestling. The reason we are here. We'll go over some news, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Continental Classic, and we'll hit the bricks. Not entirely sure if we'll have a show next week. I still don't know what my holiday schedule is because nobody tells me nothing. But news. All right. So the big story, I think, affecting AEW right now is stuff that we really don't have enough details about because it's still in flux. And additionally, the details in terms of the story, wrestling is like dead last in terms of importance to it. But Paramount is attempting a hostile takeover of Netflix as a counter to Netflix's planned purchase to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. It's really not clear at all how that's going to affect AEW and WWE because, of course, WWE is on Netflix. UFC is on Paramount. AEW is on Warner Brothers Discovery. It is, and wrestling is going to be about the last thing that these companies care about when they are discussing these deals. So it is concerning, I guess, in a certain kind of abject terror, like, in a very vague sense, but like, frankly, it's just, that's what it's going to be. Like, this is just the media scene we're in, and it's not going to get better because, you know, we don't have actual factual antitrust laws anymore, apparently. We'll just have a mega corp running everything. That'll be fine. Yeah, so that's up in the air. We'll see how that develops. It'll probably be weeks, if not months, before there's any clarity. I'd be shocked if this is a quick resolution. More wrestling specific news. MGF is expected back soon, possibly next week. I think Meltzer, that's from Brian Alvarez. I think Meltzer said that he is expected to be back on screen by World's End. Jack Perry reportedly banged up his ankle in his Wednesday match against Kazuchika Okada, but is reportedly fine. I guess Perry at one point thought that he had actually broken his ankle on the suicide dive in that match, but he was able to finish his match, and it sounds like he's actually okay. Drillistico tweeted he had surgery for an ear injury, and Darby Allin has been pulled from the C2, was replaced by Jack Perry because Darby Allin had a quote-unquote head injury. It probably rhymes with pun-pushin, but we don't know. But wrestling companies just love being afraid of saying that their wrestlers get concussions. And in the past week, Darby did do a radio interview where he said that he felt like $1 million. It should be noted that Darby Allin is a crazy person, and especially with even within the realm of pro wrestlers. So I think his idea of feeling like $1 million may not be the most practical kind or practical idea, but you know. Eddie Kingston has said that he's got 6 years left on his deal, and he's looking at retiring after it, which will put him around 49 to 50. It's Eddie Kingston, so I wouldn't be surprised if he keeps working until, like, you know, Dory Funk Jr. days. The large adult son of Sting, which is his official ring name in my heart, Stephen Borden, worked a dark match before Dynamite this week. And RJ City has wrapped up AEW, and RJ makes coffee in his underwear. But I was able to confirm that he is still with AEW. So that's some exclusive reporting right there. Maybe exclusive because no one else cares, but I did put on my reporter's hat for a little bit there. Yeah, I'm not sure what his on-screen presence will be. I assume that he's going to keep doing the pay-per-view pre-show stuff. And keep contributing to creative, as I assume he is doing. I do not know that he's doing. That is all the AEW news worth noting, I believe, at this point. I think the most interesting part is MJF, of course, coming back because he is a top star in a company that for a while had too few top stars around. And that will benefit them. And I don't know. I mean, you know, the thing with MJF is there's always the stance with like his bad creative sometimes, and also possibly being one of the best wrestlers ever under the age of 30, frankly, just in terms of all around talent, promos, in ring, everything. So You know, it'll be great to have him back, I think, but there's always the specter of the Brochachos and various other creative question marks from his past that I think will always come up with him. But of course, it'll be interesting to see how he does return. Upcoming this week, we have their show in Cardiff with Winter is Coming for Collision. I've seen five matches announced for that, which is Daniel Garcia challenging Mark Briscoe for the TNT Championship, Josh Alexander against Swerve Strickland, Claudio Castagnoli against Kenosuke Takeshita, Jamie Hayter and Chris Statlander against Julia Hart and Sky Blue, and Mike Bailey against Kevin Knight in the C2 as well, which is the Claudio Takeshita match is also in the C2. Those matches could be fantastic. And of course, we have World's End on December 27th. And there's nothing really announced for that yet, outside of the fact that we'll have the semifinals and finals of the C2 on that show. So that's our catch up on upcoming shows and news, which leaves us with what has been going on in Augusta, if I can reference that meme from a few months ago. But we got ourselves the, you know, all the stuff going on with the C2, I think, is the big story, but also the Women's Tag Team Championship Tournament. And I'm going to open with being negative here, I guess. I think that the majority, but the vast majority of the Women's Tag Team Championship Tournament was bad. And in fact, not good.
Not good is a synonym for bad.
Yes. But I think that, I mean, there's just a lot of bad work in it. And I worry that this, we're just going to, honestly, the best case for this, this title is to be used like the Trios Championship, possibly, and not be featured very much. Because I just don't know there's enough great workers to support, like, you know, really strong TBS and Women's World Championship matches and Tag Team Championship matches. So having it switched to being like a part-time belt, you know, like a true secondary title that is just kind of defended as a almost an afterthought. I hate to say that, but after watching this tournament, you know, when your second best team in ring is like making, well, yeah, I think maybe you could argue Megan Bain and Marina Shafir was the second best team in ring. It's not like they're bad, but, you know, when you've got eight options, that's number two. That's not great. I feel like it's fair to say. And every team had like a notable weak part. Mina Shirakawa, I think, looked largely bad in this tournament.
She's rough, man.
I've seen her have some decent matches before, but like, not in this tournament.
Is it over for her? Is she just cooked?
I don't know if she's just like kind of, I'm in the U.S. now, and so I don't have to work as hard. What I like to call Tokyo Joshi Pro Syndrome, maybe. But I don't know, man. Like, and God bless Harley Cameron. We've talked about her before a lot. She's got a lot of positives, I think, in her bag, but you know, the fact is that she also is like 40 matches into her career. And I mean, like, considering that, you know, it's impressive to be a decent almost. I wouldn't say she's bad, but I also wouldn't say she's good. So she's in that place in between in terms of like in-ring. Yeah, 90 career matches. All right. Like, and she is preposterously charismatic, you know, but it's the in-ring that is the weakness with her, and you know, maybe she'll keep getting better at it. I think that some people are going to look at her age of 31 and be like, oh, you can't improve once you're past your 30, but that's not how pro wrestling works from what I've seen. I just hope that, she continues to improve. I think being put in a team with Willow Nightingale is a good avenue for that to happen for her. But my biggest concern is that Willow Nightingale I think she should have been put on top of the women's division at some point this calendar year. And I know AEW prefers its longer title reigns. I'm certainly not asking for like Crash TV 2-week world title reigns or anything, right? But like, I feel like Willow's been in this holding pattern for over a year now, almost two, of like one of the three most over women on the roster, you know, up there with Toni Storm and Mercedes Moné. And those two have been pushed super hard, and Willow has been like, hey, remember Willow? She's kind of involved. See you in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Know? The whole idea of the women's tag team division is to really, in my opinion, get more ring time and more exposure and have the ability for them to go after something that's not a singles championship. I think Tony Khan on an overall level has done a very good job of navigating the women's division, because it started off, hey, we're going to build the women's division around Joshi wrestlers. Well, then the pandemic happened, and then you basically have like four women that can regularly work shows during the real meat of that pandemic. And at a certain point, you can't have them work each other all the time. Nobody's going to want to watch that after like four matches in a month, you know? Yeah. So they had to slow play it. And quite frankly, some of the women just weren't ready. And there's nothing wrong with that. The Women's Revolution, the concept of it was great for women's wrestling in the States because it was degraded for so long, mainly by the company who spearheaded the Women's Revolution. People forget that. But one of the things is when you have something like that, it's going to take a while for the depth of a division like that to be good enough to really sustain multiple companies. And that's kind of where we're at right now, where women's MMA was similar too. You had the emergence of Ronda Rousey, and it was great, but some of the lower card fighters just weren't very good. Where you could go to the men's divisions and you'd have really good lower card fighters, but there was just a depth there that wasn't in the women's division. And that's just due to people not wanting to do it because so many disrespected women's wrestling for so long. Why would, you know, theoretically, why would somebody want to go into a profession where they're going to be that disrespected and degraded? Now you're treated with a lot more reverence, a lot more respect. You are in matches that are priority matches. You're in main events. You're in semi-mains. You are treated like a normal male wrestler. You are not treated like some down card, like sideshow. You're treated like a good wrestler. Now that that's happened, it takes time to, hey, shows young girls and teenagers, hey, women's wrestling is a legitimate thing now. It's not treated like crap. It's treated like it's real. It's treated like the men are treated. You're going to start getting better athletes, better performers who want to go into wrestling. And then that's going to slowly build up the depths of those divisions. But that takes time. It does not happen overnight. And we're still in the process of that really building up. The infrastructure is not there. You could argue it's somewhat there in Joshi, but Joshi in itself has had its own ups and downs, and it did not come out of the shoot fight era nearly as strong as men's wrestling did. And men's wrestling in Japan isn't exactly thriving either. And even though the Tokyo Dome sold out, well, guess what? Hiroshi Tanahashi's last match ever against Okada. That is what sold out. You're going to get about 20 to 25,000 just for the Wrestle Kingdom name. The rest is Tanahashi Okada. Straight up. But after that, New Japan's not exactly thriving either. The only company that's truly thriving is Stardom. But you have to build up the right infrastructure. And getting these women
kind of Noah.
Yeah, Noah's been up and down. Yeah, but it's almost like average out, they're just kind of stagnant. But it's a little bit of a roller coaster with their attendance.
By Noah standards.
By Noah standards is pretty good. So the reason why I like the tag team division is because it gives more opportunities for ring time. And that is, to me, the biggest problem right now with AEW. Don't have enough opportunities for ring time. Back in the 1990s, you'd be doing the house show loop. And guess what? These lower card acts would be getting 8 to 10 minutes a night. working with the same people to perfect their skills and work on different things and be able to, hey, we did this last night. Let's do this tonight. Let's see how it works. And you're not getting those reps anymore. You have to go to like GCW and work these really bad, not well-trained wrestlers. You can try to go to West Coast Pro, but Prestige is gone. Deadlock is about to be gone. There's just not enough indie companies to really be able to hone your craft. So adding this, now, honestly, I want Dark to come back. I don't care if these women only get 5 minutes in a squash match. Guess what? They're working and they're improving. And that those squash matches help. We need that back. But we're not going to get
I'm going to push back on that last bit a little bit, if that's all right. Because I think it's a fair question of if they actually have been improving. Because you look at some people that have been there for like 3 or 4 years that we hoped would be on the come up, like Anna Jay and Ty Conti and Sky Blue and Julia Hart. And I don't think any one of those four, just to pluck these examples out, have really meaningfully improved in the ring.
Okay, so I think we're having two different conversations.
Oh, you're talking about them improving, so sorry if like...
No. I think you're talking about the minutia of are these women actually improving? And I'm talking about the idea of the more reps they get and the more they improve. So
yeah, I think more reps would improve, but like I don't think my point is I don't think the dark reps were really getting it done. So what I've said for ever since we started this show that they should be doing is sending them out, yes, to the indies where maybe they're not working with top talent, but you know, you could be making sure that they, you know, they're working with people like Masha Slamovich before she gets canceled, Jody Threat, even Nicole Matthews, who, you know, I think she has definitely had her moments over her career, or just send them over to Stardom or Tokyo Joshi Pro or whoever and be like, hey, listen, they're going to go live there for 3 months. You can book them. We'll pay them. You don't have to pay them. Keep them reasonably strong, but you don't have to like, you know, put the top belt on them and have them kill everyone or whatever. Do something like that, or even send them over for a year. I mean, look, you know, if you're assigning young talent to like lower levels of money, then it's probably in your best interest to devote like just a year of their career to them developing and hopefully becoming much better in ring. Then what I think has kind of happened with, just to pick the example, Julia Hart, who I think, you know, she's definitely shown like flash, like strong flashes of getting it in general, but like not the in-ring part. And she really hasn't progressed positively when it comes to having good matches. And I think you can go up and down the women's roster that was around in 2020, 2021, and yes, pandemic, et cetera, but that's not the entire time period. And point out like, hey, look, you know, none of these people have really upped their game significantly. And I think that's kind of why we're going to have this issue with the Women's Tag Team Championship. Unless they're like, oh, well, you know, we're just going to put it on like Chris Dallin or Mercedes Moné and also have them be the main champs. And then once in a while, just have them have a tag title defense.
So this is interesting. I'm pulling up Cage Match right now. If Cage Match will actually load, we'll find out. But I want to figure out how many matches Julia Hart has had, because I'm not going to
guess 275.
No, I'm just saying like the last 12 months.
Last 12 months?
Yeah, because the idea of
21, I'm guessing.
Well, Cage Match ain't loading, so
it's loading for me. Hold on, I almost got it.
Okay.
Looks like it has been 36.
Okay. She's 24 and she only had 36 matches, 3 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's not enough.
And she also was out from late April last year through the end of the year. Like, she came back on New Year's Day this year. Yeah. So,
someone like Julia Hart should be wrestling 80 to 100 times a year.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying that we need to go back to the days of you're on the road 300 days a year. No. But what I am saying is when you are somebody as young as Julia Hart, who has an incredible presence on television. She commands the camera. She is very, very comfortable in her role and everything that she's done. She's got great charisma. The in-ring needs to match, or at least get to a very acceptable point. And you're right, it's not there. And it's not improving nearly what we thought. Some of that, I think you can credit to the fact that she had that injury. And coming back, you know, it can take some time to, you know, get reacclimated. Let's say through February, takes 2 months for her to kind of get more comfortable with working out and all that stuff. Okay. But then what happened the last 10 months? Why haven't we seen any kind of real improvement? I think it's because she's not getting regular work. Three matches a month. This is pro wrestling. This is not playing football where, hey, you're in these car wrecks and stuff. Like, I mean, wrestling is, you're still putting your body in the line. It's still very physical, but it's much more controlled. You have control over what your body is doing. And you're only going, a lot of these matches for someone like Julia Hart, you're going like 7-8 minutes. We need more. This is where like Dark would be really nice. Or if Tony Khan could just be like, hey, I want to bring you back AEW Dark. Let's just put it on HBO Max.
What I think Tony Khan should do is make ROH a proper promotion, by which I mean don't be taping your matches before and after Dynamite when people are tired or aren't there yet or are leaving. You need to just like go down to that soundstage in Orlando or someplace similar. Just do it at Jackson's, you know, make Daily Place similar to Full Sail or whatever, and just go in and for one day a month tape 4 episodes of proper TV and not like this sloth the Ring of Honor is on a weekly basis.
Now, I do understand what Tony Khan is doing here, because you used to be able to go to a Dynamite and you'd get a Rampage taping. So you'd get an extra hour. So you would get essentially a 3.5-hour wrestling show with some teardown and some setup. Okay. That I understand. You're trying to give more value for the dollar, you know, and Rampage, it's going to be on TNT. I think that's a good idea. It's smart business. But the problem is, now that it's ROH, you're telling people, nah, we're different because we're into the minutiae of pro wrestling. We cover it. So we view things from a different lens, friend. The average fan, and I don't want to bring up the mythical casual fan bullshit because that's not what I'm talking about. The average pro wrestling fan is turning it on Wednesday nights and then buying some pay-per-views. They are not reading articles. They are not listening to podcasts. They just want to watch it like they would watch Scrubs, or they would watch Beverly Hills 90210. They just want to turn it on, watch it, and then move on with their day. You're telling them by making it Ring of Honor that I don't need to pay attention to this because I'm an AEW fan. People aren't paying attention to it. Tony Khan doesn't take it seriously with how he presents the product.
Well, and part of the problem is he gave in to the people that were like bad faithing. Oh, I don't want to see the Ring of Honor world champion on AEW TV. Like, you know, you much like the rankings, you should have just ignored them on that. And be like, this is how we work and suck it up. But I mean, I Jason Hart for our site tried to review the weekly TV for Ring of Honor and gave up after, I think it was 4 months, because it's a crappy show that nothing happens on. You're lucky to get, you're fortunate if you get a great match once a month on that TV show, or, you know, the streaming show or whatever you want to call it. It's really atrocious TV.
And, yeah, it's not good.
No. And like, I'm not saying that the workers in there are bad or anything, but when every show's like 15 3-minute matches, you know, it's not 1981 anymore.
Yeah.
It's a cat tries to steal food for my wife, apparently.
Something needs to change from the Ring of Honor perspective. Personally, Fred, just make Ring of Honor dark. Do some basic storylines and then just...
It's dark. That's the problem.
No, but they should treat it like they treated Dark at the end.
They're treating it like that's the problem.
No, because they're half-assing both sides. You can't half-ass two things. Whole-ass one thing. And record a month's worth of TV in a weekend, then you have it. You know what? If you want to treat it like it's Dark, I think you can still present a much better product than what we're getting, because they're trying to do a real TV show and it's awful.
I don't think they are. I think they're just doing Dark with different colors. I mean, like, listen to this. This is the last episode of Ring of Honor and Honor Club. Spanish Announced Project defeats Josh Crane and LSG in 5 minutes, 8 seconds. Dark Order defeats the Frat House in 7 minutes, 18 seconds. Zeta Steel defeats Rachel Ellering in 6 minutes, 7 seconds. Jay Lethal defeats Nathan Cruz, 5 minutes, 48 seconds. Deonna Purrazzo and Madison Rayne defeat Billy Starks and Diamante in 4 minutes, 49 seconds. Hechicero defeats Josh Woods in 7 minutes, 11 seconds. If that match got 15 minutes, I would have been watching that. Adam Priest.
That sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it was like pretty good, but 7 minutes, you know. I want you to guess how long it took for this match to finish. Adam Priest, Dalton Castle, The Outrunners, and Tommy Billington against MXM TV, so Johnny TV, Mansoor, and Mason Madden, and the Premier Athletes. How long do you think that match lasted? 10-man tag team match.
Well, it should have lasted about 12 minutes. It probably got 7.
It got 4 minutes, 30 seconds. Ring of Honor Women's World Television Title Proving Ground Match. Red Velvet defeats Lacey Lane in 5 minutes, 20 seconds. The Death Riders defeat Aaron Solo in 4 minutes, 48 seconds. And then your main event is Commander and Skyflight defeating the Shane Taylor Promotions in 9 minutes, 4 seconds. Literally no matches hitting double digits of minutes. Only one getting to 9.
See, that's the problem. They have this delusion that this is a good television show, when in reality, the matches you're just throwing out are dark. So just lean into the fact this is just AEW dark. Just go with it.
That's what it is. That's how they treat it. Like, what you're proposing is what they're doing, and it's not working.
That's not how they're thinking about it, though. They're thinking about this is an actual television show with stories.
No, they aren't trying with this. This is a complete afterthought. Like, I would argue that maybe they're not even putting as much effort into it as Dark at points. Would you like to guess how many matches that aired on the Honor Club show have a 7.5 or better on Cage Match this year? Not counting the pay-per-views, just the Honor Club streaming TV show. The entire year. It is December 12th.
6.
2. 2 matches. Alex Windsor, Suri on October 2nd, or at least that was when they taped it, and Blake Christian and Lee Johnson against Commander and Mascara Dorada. All year, they had 2 matches worth a damn as far as quality on that show.
Good old Vanilla Baby.
All right. Let's talk about the good wrestling, which is kind of a classic. Outside of the fact that Tony Khan refuses to announce a schedule for any tournament he ever does, because I don't know why. It's truly an astonishing thing that he really sticks to, and I will never comprehend. This tournament's been really awesome, and I thought we'd be coming on here talking about how John Moxley, Konosuke Takeshita had like a 4.25, 4.5 star level match on Collision about a week ago now, and how that was the match of the tournament. And then Kyle Fletcher, Mike Bailey this week laughed at that and said, "Nice try, guys," and stole the damn show. On what was one of the better, maybe the best Dynamite of the year. I don't know. But that they had a legit 5 star match. Meltzer went 5.25 on it. On Dynamite this week, that absolute fantastic performances by both guys. That same show had Jack Perry in an actually really, really good singles match. So he might be getting off my shit list soon if he keeps this up. They had the best match of the tag tournament all tournament, with Willow Nightingale and Harley Cameron beating Mercedes Moné, God bless, Tony Storm and Mina Shirakawa. and they did it in a straight match and not like a gimmick Street Fighter or whatever. That, and they tried that with the semis and it didn't really work in either of those to kind of cover up the warts. And this was just a great episode of Dynamite, and the Continental Classic, really strong Eddie Kingston versus Samoa Joe match, which I could have seen being kind of a mess, honestly, because I don't think Eddie's been great since his return, but he stepped up for this match, and Samoa Joe had maybe his best outing of his title reign, to be honest, which, I mean, it hasn't been that long, but still, still a strong performance by him, and yeah, I love this episode of Dynamite this week, and I think the Continental Classic is off to a great start.
Yeah, I want to talk about that Fletcher speedball match, because one of my big things is, and I know we've talked about it, you are on the same wavelength as I am, Fred. Flash pins are good, but it's also about how you react to the flash pin. They are so tiring to see all this horseshit surrounding all these faces. Like,
oh, the NXT face that Kyle Fletcher did after he was rolled up.
Be pissed. It's okay.
I would even say that like Fletcher's reaction wasn't bad in a vacuum, but the fact is we're not in a vacuum. We're in a world where like every shocking roll-up defeat, one every time there's a flash pin, seemingly it's an upset, except for when Okada did it a week ago.
Shock face is just the new ladder match.
It's just, yeah, it's just like everyone does it, and it's like, this isn't, you can vary this. When Okada pit, you know, got the small package on Pac last week, Pac sold it by just like kind of being numb. And I thought he did a great job in comparison to like what's going on. I can't really fault like in a vacuum Kyle Fletcher's job there, but it has done way too much. It's a lazy trope at this point, and it's something that has to be avoided. And it's not his fault or anything. It's just in wrestling in 2025, anytime there's like a close kick out or a surprise pinfall, you know, it has to be sold by someone doing the mouth agape emoji reaction. And it was ruined by NXT and WWE, unfortunately.
What a shock.
If it was a shock, I'd be sitting here like, ah! Right.
That's good.
Or the ringside cam, I should say. But yeah, I thought this week's episode was one of their best episodes of the year. They had maybe the best TV match of the year for them with Fletcher Bailey, and pretty into the tournament right now. So really excited to see where it goes from here. I think that it seems like we always get a little negativity right before the tournament about the tournament. And it's a little weird because I would say that the Continental Classic is not disappointed yet. Now, and they always manage to be like really silly with the whole, which, you know, they somehow always make which belt is on the line confusing. And they always like the failure to put out a schedule ahead of time, though I imagine they're doing that because they don't want to risk having issues because of injury or something. But not having it out there ahead of time really kind of limits people's ability to get excited and to like circle dates and be like, I want to watch this match on this day. I think that would be smart for them to do. But it's, you know, outside of those, like, you know, if you're going to stack them up when you have those quibbles, and then on the other hand, you have like the torment Okada's having, which I think is really great. And you have Moxley Takeshita, you have Fletcher Bailey. And I don't think really a bad match yet. I don't, you know, definitely not a bad match by me. I don't even think like a disappointing match yet. I think that means that so far you have to declare this a complete success. Now, I do hope that they don't fall into the like, oh, we have a three-way tie, so that we're going to do a triple threat at the pay-per-view for a semi-main event. You know, I'd like to avoid that, but, you know, fingers crossed, I think we're going to get a great tournament the rest of the way.
Yeah, I'm very excited about what this is going to end up being. And
it's really well booked too. We've got nice surprise wins. Dorado over Claudio was pretty awesome. They're keeping guys feeling like threats that you might write off a little too easily. And you've got like Roderick Strong stepping up from where he is sometimes, where he's just kind of like, eh, you know, I'm in the mid card. Who cares? I think that, and getting to see him, or even Claudio, who I think sometimes maybe isn't the most inspired by his booking, if I can read into, you know, do some armchair psychiatry, I think both, both could have like, both are responding to the message of like, hey, you're in a big spot, have a big match. And it's awesome to see.
The one thing I like about the Continental Classic is it's only six guys in each block, which means you're not, for lack of a better term, scraping the bottom of the barrel. You don't have to put in a guy like Yano. You don't have to put in like Pin Eaters. You don't have to have, oh, I need to put a Young Lion in here. And then all of a sudden they're just losing every match. I mean, it's a great experience for them, but everybody can beat everybody and it doesn't really hurt anyone, because it's the style is so much different than your standard. Hey, it's a pay-per-view match. So you get 30, it's a 30 minute time limit, which I believe is standard in AEW for just a normal singles match. This is 20. There are no seconds. It is just wrestle. Mm-hmm. And you have to wrestle in a different style. Yeah. The G1 matches are constructed like that too. Like Omega Okada are known for having these long epic matches, and their one G1 match was they sprinted. I mean, it's like a 28 minute sprint, but they knew they had to get going right away, because if I'm going to wear this guy down, I need to start early. It's a different kind of strategy. And in canon, you can convince yourself that, hey, Speedball got Fletcher because they had to wrestle in a much quicker match, and that plays into Speedball's strengths. So Fletcher couldn't like draw it out and methodically beat him. No, he had to go. And you can tell yourself, okay, that's why he lost. It hurts nobody. It helps Speedball. Speedball is the perfect guy you would stick in a G1. He'd get 8 or 10 points every single year. And he'd have really good matches. He'd probably pull one upset. He'd probably get beat by somebody like Yano. And then he'd just have good 3.5 to 4.5 star matches throughout the tournament. Like, I think they're doing a really good job of structuring some of this because of who they have in there. They don't have Pin Eaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's all... I mean
that in a good way. Like,
Yeah.
Not, hey, the Don Callis family is going to get a tag team title shot against Brodito. Well, you got to pin one of Okada or Takeshita. You don't have to book the match. But the Continental Classics is such a different realm where if you lose, it doesn't hurt you. Like the same way it would if it was just a normal singles match or a tag match. I like
that. Yeah, they're not all main eventers. Like Roderick Strong really isn't. But like,
you know what Roddy would be perfect for? ROH World Champion. If ROH was an actual company, he'd be a great ROH World Champion.
Oh yeah.
I think he'd go on like a year long title reign and just give guys shots, build up Lee Johnson for 6 months, then give him a title shot. It'll be his first major title shot. And then beat him in a pay-per-view. And then, hey, guess what? Now you've established Lee Johnson as a credible threat to wrestle for the world title. All right. Do it with a couple other guys. And then have somebody beat him. And then, hey, give the belt to Lee Johnson after, like you get a transitional champion after Roddy holds it for, like, 14 months. Have the next guy hold it for, like, 4 or 5. And then Johnson wins the belt. And now, all of a sudden, you've just spent 18 months building up a guy that you really believe in. Like, that'd be perfect for Roddy, but we're never going to get that.
Yeah. There's so much they could be doing with Ring of Honor, and it's a real point of frustration. I just don't see it changing, unfortunately. And,
Yeah, I don't see it happening either, man. I really don't. But, and it's frustrating because you have Brian Danielson. Just give him the book and be like, all right, this is my general theme. Go have fun. Be a degenerate. Complimentary speaking.
You could really make it a fun promotion pretty easily. But
are you telling me that Chris Hero and Brian Danielson sitting together on a creative team couldn't book a fun ass wrestling show with that roster? That's not a bad roster. It's an underutilized roster.
I would adore to be the booker of that promotion. I think that'd be so much fun. Mm-hmm. Being the booker of like a C show and just being like, all right, who do you want me to push, Tony? And just going through that.
Yeah. Like you have people like Red Velvet, who is never gonna be a big star in AEW. Good Hand. This Swirl tag team, which is one of the funniest names of all time. I love that name so much. Good Hands.
Yeah, they're a good team. This would be a perfect place for
team champions.
This would be a perfect place to have Top Flight slotted until you figure out what you're doing with them and if you're gonna bother with Darius.
What's going on with him, man?
I don't know. I don't want to be like a body shame person, but he is notably bigger since his injury, and I don't know that it's really in a conducive way to his style. I hope I can say that without being an asshole. That's a point of concern for his career going forward. But, you know, Dante Martin really did feel like about 2 years ago or something, like he could have been a top star, and then he broke his leg, and then he's really done. I shouldn't say top star, but like a really solid like guy you develop into being like a mid-card regular, you know,
TNT champion.
Yeah, TNT level guy. And he's not there right now. So
he had all of the skills as far as a high flyer. Plus, he had a frame. Like, mm-hmm. Please just go along with me when I make this comparison.
Okay.
He could have had a Will Ospreay career arc in the fact that he started out as a high-flying junior, and then as his career went along, when he got into his late 20s, he bulked up, stopped the high-flying, and then became more of a mat-based wrestler. Like, that's what we could have had with Dante Martin. You build him up as this high-flyer, super exciting, can do all these cool things, and then he slowly grows and develops his body and then becomes a real technician. We could have had that same arc. He's not Will Ospreay, but we're talking archetype. We're talking path as far as what the in-ring is, and you could have done a similar thing with him. And I think the injury really hurt because he was doing a lot of good stuff at the time. Darius continuing to get hurt really stunted any significant push. They tried a couple things, but Top Flight came in and they were this young, exciting, high-flying act. Shout out Minnesota. I love Minnesota. But it just sucks, man.
Mm-hmm.
It just sucks.
It's frustrating. Definitely would have hoped for further progression from them. But, you know, this is definitely a theme with AEW, unfortunately, is the young talent not moving as far along as you would hope. And I don't know if, like, at some point, you know, it's not now, but at some point, the problem of your young talent at the beginning being now established talent, as a wrestling promotion, you do need to consistently be pushing newer talent of some sort. And there's not a lot of options left globally unless you're going to start like taking in CMLL talent. And frankly, I think that, you know, I just don't see them doing that for various reasons. Some of it being the mindset that you have to cut a promo. But I mean, with all that, like who is that next wave of stars that they're going to develop and push in like 2 years or 6 months, you know, in their future? Like, is it going to be Kevin Knight? Maybe this is the beginning of Kevin Knight becoming a real top star, but you know, beyond him on the men's side, I don't know. And on the women's, like, I guess you could count Willow Nightingale, but that's more of a, haven't pulled a trigger after like 18 months, you know?
Why haven't they pulled the trigger yet, man?
It's crazy, but that's kind of, we already yelled about that too. So yeah, I think the short term is a good place, relatively good place, because obviously better attendance and all that would be valuable. But long term, there's some holes and they need to be thinking about it, I think.
Yeah. It's, I don't really have any issue with who they're pushing right now. They don't want Swerve and Hangman to have the title right now because they're doing their own thing and having them revolve around a champion who's secondary. Samoa Joe's perfect for that role because he's incredibly credible as a champion because he's a fucking badass. I don't mind that. I don't mind the fact that Okada, he's almost 40, but it's Okada and he's still good. You have Takeshita who you're quiet pushing and he's the IWGP champion. I don't really look at this roster and be like, oh, this guy should be getting the mega push right now instead of this guy. I don't see that. I think Kevin Knight, they're getting him. They have him in this tag team. He's getting a chance in the C2, but you're not in a position where you have to mega push this guy. He's only 28. He's getting a lot of reps against some really good wrestlers and he's performing well. You can pull the trigger on him in a year, no problem. Fletcher, they're giving them a huge push and he's 27 now. I think they're doing right by some of these guys, but part of the problem is when you have, and it's just going to sound weird to say because I think they have a development problem at an overall level. But when you have the roster that they have, I don't know how you can be mad that you're not really investing so much time into younger wrestlers when you have a wealth of talent that honestly isn't being at the top, that isn't being utilized nearly as well as they could be just because there's not enough time. And it's a tough conundrum because the whole point of wrestling is you have to have the next guy ready. New Japan should have just pushed the fuck out of Yota Tsuji, Shota Umino, and Ren Narita right away. But it's Gato, and he slow plays it. You don't have the golden age. You don't have Okada Tanahashi to go back to. You don't have Naito. You don't have Nakamura. You got to push these guys now. And we're not in that position, but we did see things dipped without Swerve and Ospreay, and they didn't really have anywhere to really turn to. So they should be working harder to get these guys ready. But I also, on the counterpoint, I understand it's a little harder to do so when you have bigger stars who are still in like the peak of their career. It makes it a really tough decision. And that's why I'm not a booker. Because I don't know if I'd be doing much better. But yeah. I can at least identify that, hey, we need to be doing better. I just unfortunately don't have an answer on what that is right now.
Yeah, but it is an issue that they're facing, I think, and it's something they need to be cognizant of. But
you know. I agree.
Yeah. I think that's all I got this week. You got anything else you want to add?
No, I don't. I'm excited to see the rest of the Continental Classic. Next week is the Texas High School State Football Championships, which I will be watching in full. I love watching high school football state titles. It's just high school football is such a pure sport, man. Like, you're not headhunting. You're not. I mean, I guess technically NIL exists at the high school level, but it's not the same. Like, so many of these kids are just playing for the love of the game, but they're not going to go to college. They're not going to play ball. It's so much fun to watch. It's most of the time it's bad, but it's just pure. And I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it'll be a good time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to make a donation to us, you can with Red Circle. It'll be a link in the show description, blah, blah, blah. Otherwise, thanks for joining us. Join us next time, which maybe next week or maybe next year. I don't know. we'll figure it out. There'll be a show when there is.
Yeah, it's with the Christmas holiday being on a Thursday and the Minnesota Vikings with my shoot job playing on Christmas Day. Going to make it a little bit more difficult to get a show. We'll see what we can do. If you don't hear from us before then, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah, which is currently right now. I believe Hanukkah started yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. Yesterday or Wednesday?
I'm not sure.
Whatever holiday you celebrate, we hope you have a great one. If you don't celebrate any of them, I just hope you have a good day of the week.
There you go.
Take care. God bless. Enjoy AEW.
See y'all.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format. where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network listeners. I am Jeff Hawkins, co-host of Shake Them Ropes, with a very special announcement. If it's been a while or you've never listened to us before, the original gang is back, myself and Rob McCarron. Back talking wrestling. We have no idea where this show's going to go, where we're going to keep any of the old bits or any of the old things in there. It's going to be a process. It's going to be a journey, and we'd like for you to come along with us only on Shake Them Ropes on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.